Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to this podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
A warm, pleasant summer breeze swept across the great harbor of Constantinople. It was just a few days after the summer solstice, and the sun hung high in the sky. Standing beside the docks, the Patriarch of Constantinople, the highest religious official in the city, shouted out a blessing in Greek. The notes of his prayer and the other sounds belching forth from the harbor floated off into the breeze. Swords, spears, and shields clanged off armor as thousands of men jostled together, waiting to board a fleet of hundreds of ships. Requests, commands, and questions in Latin, Greek, Bulgar, Syriac, and a half dozen other languages filled the air. Carters and porters carried all the supplies the men would need on their expedition through the streets to the docks. They loaded thousands of loaves of bread, amphorae filled with wine and olive oil, arrows, spare weapons, and more onto the ships. Thousands of men filed up the gangways onto the waiting ships. Their booted feet and the hooves of their horses thudded on the wooden decks. Amidst all this activity, one man just watched the proceedings. He was dressed in rich purple robes of the finest silk. The summer sunlight glinted off the golden diadem on his forehead. His name was Justinian. It was his will that this fleet and army go forth. First Africa, then Italy, and finally the entirety of what had once been the Western Roman Empire would return to a state of perfect imperial unity. The barbarian kingdoms, the Vandals in Africa, the Ostrogoths in Italy, the Visigoths in Spain, the Franks in Gaul, would all be humbled by the might of a resurgent empire. That was Justinian's program. The Patriarch of Constantinople finished his blessing. The expedition was ready to move. The year was 533. The time had come for the Roman Empire to strike back. From Wondery, this is Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me today. Justinian was the last great Roman emperor. Over the course of his 38-year reign, from 527 to 565, his armies returned Africa, Italy, and part of Spain to the direct rule of the empire for the first time in more than half a century. He launched a building project, maybe the most ambitious in all of Roman history. We can still see its fruits today in the Hagia Sophia in Constantinople. He also fully codified Roman law for the first time in over a millennium in the Corpus Iuris Civilis, also known as the Justinianic Code. This was the form through which Roman law would reach later generations. Even today, it's still shaping Western legal practices. In all of these things, Justinian embodied the centuries-old legacy of the Roman Empire. Its accomplishments in architecture and building, its legal frameworks, and above all, its raw power and territorial control. But Justinian also marked the end of something distinctly Roman. He was probably the last emperor to speak Latin as his native language. In its strident, reactionary ideology, Justinian's regime pointed away from the Roman past and toward the Byzantine future. Justinian was a colossus of a figure. He stood astride two eras. One foot landed firmly in the past of antiquity. The other sat just as firmly in the Middle Ages. Justinian's accomplishments, and there were many, will be our topic here in today's episode. But Justinian's victories over barbarian kingdoms and sorting out the tangled thickets of Roman law aren't the only reason why his reign marked such a turning point. Unfortunately for Justinian, a series of natural disasters racked both the Roman Empire and the entirety of the Mediterranean world and beyond. The climate shifted, producing the coldest years on record in the last two millennia. Millions died from plague on a scale that had never been seen before. If we're looking for a turning point between the Roman world and the one that followed, there's no better place to find it than right here. Those natural disasters are what we'll talk about next week. So who was Justinian? Well, the future emperor was born with the name Petrus Sabbatius in a small town in the Balkans called Torizium. It's in present-day Macedonia, about 12 miles from the capital, Skopje. Torizium was a sleepy backwater. If we want to understand Justinian and what made him tick, we always have to keep that in mind. He was a provincial, and he knew it. So did everybody else. The late Roman Balkans were a fascinating and essential corner of the empire. These provinces of Thrace and Illyricum weren't rich and fertile like Egypt. They didn't grow fancy wines like Greece or Gaza. They didn't produce tons of pottery and olive oil like North Africa, or fish sauce like Spain. What the Balkan provinces produced were soldiers. This was the frontier, or close to it. Its inhabitants were hardy and militarized. They were closely tied to the Roman army and its institutions over the course of many generations. The whole region was repeatedly invaded, fought over, overrun, and rebuilt. The Balkans became a melting pot. This was where the Goths had been settled in the 380s after the Battle of Adrianople. Huns, Ostrogoths, and many other groups followed during and after the time of Attila's empire in the middle of the 5th century. There were other frontier zones in the Roman Empire, of course. In the west, there was Britain and northern Gaul. In the south, there were the lines along the Sahara. In the east, there was the long, well-defended frontier with the Persians. But none of them could match the Balkans in terms of the sheer extent of militarization and barbarization. Here, barbarian and Roman military cultures fused to create a unique kind of provincial society that evolved and lasted for generations. If the Balkans were just one of the Roman Empire's regions, it would be interesting as kind of a testament to the diversity of the empire. But it was much more than that. You see, the Balkans were the home of practically all the late Roman Empire's ruling dynasties, from the crisis of the 3rd century up until the beginning of the 7th century. Diocletian, who set the empire to rights after the crisis, he was a soldier from Illyricum. Constantine the Great's father was born in Dardania in the northern Balkans. Constantine himself was born in Nisus in what's now Serbia. Valentinian I, who followed Constantine's dynasty in the 360s, was from Pannonia in what's now Croatia. The only exception was the Theodosian dynasty, originally from Spain, and they came to power at a moment of crisis. Justinian was born into this provincial Balkan culture. His uncle, Justin, had trekked to Constantinople to seek his fortune in the 470s. He joined the army and rose through the ranks of the palace guards. Justin eventually became emperor in 518. Justinian, just simple Petrus Sabbatius then, had gone to join his uncle at some point in his youth. He had risen along with him. Justin eventually adopted him as a son, hence the name Justinian. Constantinople's political and social elites never forgot that Justin and Justinian were provincial rustics. Procopius, the great historian of Justinian's reign, sniffed in his secret history that Justinian was, quote, like a barbarian. That kind of sotto voce criticism came up over and over again, even decades after Justinian had left the Balkans and headed for Constantinople. Justinian's provincial origins shaped him and later his policies in really meaningful ways. He was a hardliner. He had a strong and distinct idea of what it meant to be Roman. In a deeply conservative society, he was a reactionary. One of my favorite books on this period is called People and Identity in Ostrogothic Italy by a guy named Patrick Amory. It makes a ton of thought-provoking points, but one that has never gotten enough play among scholars is the realization that the Balkans were just an incredible melting pot of people and ideas. It was that melting pot that produced this whole period's really towering, important figures. Justinian is one. Another is Theodoric the Great, the Ostrogothic king who ruled Italy. He was something like a Western emperor in the first few decades of the 6th century, even though he was a Goth. For more on him and the Ostrogoths, you can go back and check out the Fall of Rome show, episode 17. But anyway, Justinian and Theodoric were flip sides of the same coin. They both came out of this militarized provincial context. They both had connections and relatives in high places. But Theodoric took the Gothic route, and Justinian took the Roman road. If things had gone just a little differently, it's easy to see how Theodoric might have ended up a Roman general, or Justinian as a frontier warlord. It's precisely because of that similarity in background that both Justinian and Theodoric were so strident about their ideologies. Both were consciously trying to create a sense of identity, of what it meant to be Gothic or Roman. It makes sense that people who were raised in a melting pot where identity is up for grabs are so concerned with creating and enforcing it. Why does this matter? Well, it matters because we can't understand Justinian's actions, his building projects, his legal code, and above all, his conquests, without understanding how he justified and thought about his actions. Justinian's reign wasn't just a turning point in terms of what he did, but in terms of how people thought about the Roman Empire and what it meant to be Roman. To be clear, Justinian himself wasn't solely responsible for this. Constantinople in the 510s, 520s, and 530s was bursting with new ideas about all these things. But Justinian was the pivotal figure. He was the person around whom all of this revolved. He was, of course, the emperor. But let's come back to Justinian's career. We know very little about his early life. We know where he was born, and we know that he eventually came to the capital following the rising star of his uncle Justin. When the emperor Anastasius died without an obvious heir in 518, Justin emerged as the consensus compromise candidate to succeed him. It says a very great deal that a 36-year-old Justinian was also apparently under consideration at the same time. From the very beginning of Justin's reign, Justinian was his right-hand man. He built a church dedicated to Saints Peter and Paul. He held the post of Magister Militum Praesentalis, and then he served as consul. Through these things, Justinian was able to insinuate himself into the political life of the capital. He cultivated the heir to the throne of the Vandal kingdom in North Africa, Hilderic. He sent him rich gifts of gold and convinced him to convert from the Arian brand of Christianity to Orthodox Christianity. That's something we'll come back to shortly, because this was a pretty important detail later in Justinian's life. We also see Justinian writing letters to Pope Hormisdas in Rome in the late 510s or early 520s. Now let me tell you, I've read every Latin language letter written in this period. I'm not exaggerating, I've read every single one. Justinian stand out from the pack. Unlike those written by the imperial chancery or a rhetorically trained aristocrat, Justinian's are kind of rough. He clearly knew what the style of this kind of letter was supposed to look like. He shot for that kind of eloquence, but his letters just never quite get there. They're clunky and awkward. One modern critic's unkind assessment of them was that they were, quote, marred by lapses into vulgarity. I wouldn't go that far, but in a world of hyper-educated political and cultural elites, it's pretty obvious that Justinian just didn't quite belong there. It was yet another reason for city aristocrats to look down their noses at people like Justin and Justinian. It also didn't help that both were married to women who weren't exactly chaste daughters of the blue-blooded aristocracy. Justinian's wife, Theodora, was born the daughter of a bear keeper of the circus in Constantinople. When her father died, Theodora's mother put her three daughters on the stage as actresses. From there, Theodora transitioned to prostitution, eventually becoming the mistress of the governor of the province of Libya, Pentapolis. When she returned to Constantinople after a quarrel, she and Justinian got together. It took a special dispensation to allow them to marry, because men of Justinian's rank were forbidden, by law, from marrying an actress. They did marry, though, and Theodora became a force in her own right and one of Justinian's most trusted advisors. Justin was elderly when he came to the throne in 518, but he managed to hang on for 9 years before he finally died in 527. At that point, Justinian took over. He had been preparing for the role for years. In his secret history, the historian Procopius calls Justin a donkey with long, flapping ears. It was Justinian pulling the reins, Procopius said. By the time of Justin's death, he had already made Justinian co-emperor. It was the smoothest imperial transition in living memory. Justinian wasted little time in getting his agenda off the ground. From the very beginning, we can see a strident emphasis on the idea of renovatio, renewal. This renewal would take many forms: laws, building programs, and above all, reconquest.
If you were cooking a meal back in, say, 1350, you'd have to spend hours every day gathering ingredients, grinding grain into flour, picking out a chicken, and you know how that part goes, and slaving over a sweltering fire. But nowadays, things have gotten a lot easier. For example, I'm looking at a box right now that just landed on my doorstep from HelloFresh. Inside is everything I need to cook some fantastic meals. Here are the bags of pre-measured ingredients, each one of them clearly labeled. I don't know a leek from a scallion, so this is a godsend. Dang, that pork chop looks good. And here are the step-by-step instruction cards, complete with pictures. I know nothing about cooking, and even I can follow these. HelloFresh offers new, chef-curated recipes every week. Whatever your tastes, they've got a plan for you. There's classic with meat and fish. There's veggie with plant-based proteins and grains. And there's family with quick, easy, and delicious meals for the whole family. You choose your plan, your meal, even your delivery day. It's incredibly convenient. So, which meal to choose? All right, I'm going to try the pork chop with green beans and jasmine rice, topped off with a pineapple salsa. Wow. Never in a million years would I have thought I could put something like that together. Dang, this is starting to smell pretty great. What are you waiting for? For $30 off your first week of HelloFresh, visit HelloFresh.com and enter the promo code TIDES30. That's HelloFresh.com. Use the promo code TIDES30.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
It might seem natural to us to think of Justinian's wars in the West as reconquest, but that wasn't necessarily the case at the time. After all, Theodoric the Great and his Ostrogoths had shown up in Italy on an imperial commission. At least theoretically, he and his successors were ruling Italy on behalf of the Eastern Emperor. Other barbarian kings paid lip service to the idea of imperial overlordship. In practice, that meant very little. But it was a useful mental framework for everybody to hang on to. Folks could pretend that in some basic sense, things were pretty much as they had always been. That was beginning to change in the first few decades of the 6th century. By the time Justinian took the throne in 527, those changes were crystallizing into a set of concepts, an ideology that would drive his policies. At the core of this was the idea that things had gone downhill from an imagined time of imperial perfection, that the Western Roman Empire had fallen. This might seem surprising. You'd think that people in the Eastern Roman Empire would be paying close attention to what was happening on the other side of the Mediterranean, in the other empire. They actually were. This is something that we talked about back in the two episodes we did on the Eastern Empire in the 5th century. The Eastern emperors were paying attention. They invested a ton of time and money and effort in trying to prevent that long succession of disasters in the West. Even after Romulus Augustulus had been deposed, they stayed involved. After all, that's how Theodoric ended up in Italy. So if they were paying attention, why didn't they see a fall happening? Well, that's because fall is a complicated thing. It's a concept, an argument, a framework, an imposition of a particular way of looking at a series of events. It's not just a literal description of that series of events.
Historians today are still arguing about whether fall is the right way to think about everything that happened between the 4th and the 6th centuries. As you can probably guess, I do. Some other people don't. We'll talk about why that is at length in some upcoming episodes. With all of that in mind, it makes sense that it took some time for folks in the East to come around to the idea that the West had actually fallen. That process began around 500, when a Greek-speaking historian and civil servant, a real traditionalist named Zosimus, referred to the West in a history he wrote as lost. This idea gathered momentum as Justin and then Justinian consolidated power. The first reference to the year 476 as the end of the empire in the West when Romulus Augustulus was deposed didn't come until 527. There's a great article on this by a scholar named Brian Croak, who makes the argument that the choice of 476 was a conscious one. It took 50 years for that increasing sense of loss to manifest itself. It's not a coincidence that 527 was the year Justinian became emperor. The author of the text that chose 476 as that fateful year, a guy named Count Marcellinus, was Justinian's secretary. Relations between the Eastern Empire and the barbarian kingdoms in the West were actually pretty decent at this point. Hilderic, the Catholic Vandal king in North Africa, was on good terms with Justinian. The Ostrogoths were under the leadership of Queen Amalasuentha, while her son, Athalaric, was a minor. We have plenty of diplomatic letters between Amalasuentha and the court of Constantinople that attest to a solid, pretty close relationship. But currents of thought about the loss of the West were still there. What's more, they were growing into a full-fledged ideological program. This program was a heady mixture of things. That idea that things had gotten worse and that there was an overly romanticized past moment where the empire had been run well. That the Roman Empire was divinely inspired, the instrument of God on earth. That it was eternally victorious and that any territorial losses were only temporary. That the emperor was a semi-divine figure in his own right. And that regularity and above all order in law, religion, and political control were the ultimate goal. The upshot was this. If the state of reality didn't match this sense of how the world was supposed to operate, reality must be made to conform. The historian Michael Moss summed up Justinian beautifully. Quote, self-righteously pious, overbearing, and bent on change. The idea of renovatio, of imperial renewal, was growing in power and force. In Justinian's hands, this went well beyond the standard Roman reverence for the past. Gothic envoys called him an innovator and hostile to what is established. Even Romans agreed. Those weren't compliments in a deeply conservative society. But the way Justinian framed his innovations was in terms of returning to an idealized past. An imagined tradition of the way things had been, of a moment of perfect Roman imperial order and regularity, that was a powerful justification for Justinian to do whatever he wanted. In reality, much of it was substantively new. The codification of the laws, the building programs, the fusion of militant Christian orthodoxy with an expanding empire, the attempted reconquest of provinces that hadn't been directly controlled for at least 50 years. Throwing it back to the language and concepts of a deep and revered past was just a way of justifying divisive and disruptive programs. Realpolitik might dictate maintaining good relationships with the barbarian kingdoms, but with such a strong sense of what had been lost gnawing at the margins of Eastern Roman politics, that just couldn't last forever. The mixture of ideological ferment and opportunity would come soon enough. Justinian had a couple of things to take care of first, though. At the beginning of 528, just months into his reign, Justinian launched the enormous project of codifying the empire's laws. It's hard to overstate what a big deal this was. Theodosius II had put together a much smaller compendium a century before called the Theodosian Code, but that wasn't fully comprehensive. Aside from that effort, which was still substantial, nobody had codified Roman law in a millennium. We're talking about thousands upon thousands upon thousands of legal rulings. Some of them dated back to the 4th century BC. Their language was so archaic that it was almost impossible to understand 1,000 years later. Others, even those dealing with the same topic, were completely contradictory. An imperial ruling from the time of Augustus might take the opposite tack from one of Diocletian. Theodosius the Great might have gone an entirely different direction. The result, what's known as the Corpus Iuris Civilis, the body of civil law, was an explicitly ideological project. It was deeply connected to Justinian's ideas about imposing consistency. Listen to the introduction of the text when it was completed in 534, just after the reconquest of Africa. He lists all the traditional names and victory titles, a practice that goes back centuries. Then it launches in, quote, "So great is the providence of divine humanity toward us that it always deigns to sustain us by acts of eternal generosity. A tempered compendium of the ancient laws, which until now were weighed down by old age, has at last stood forth in a new beauty, which nobody before our rule had ever hoped for, nor did anyone even think it possible by human intelligence. For it is marvelous that consistency could be imposed upon Roman law, so that nothing contrary or repetitive should be discovered within it." We see the whole kit and caboodle right there, the fundamental newness framed in the language of respect for the past, the mania for order and regularity. The sheer speed and comprehensiveness of the undertaking were stunning. It had taken a decade to compile the Theodosian Code, which was a much smaller collection. It took only 6 years for Justinian's experts to compile something much, much, much larger. That, right there, is Justinian in a nutshell. The laws were just one thing Justinian had to get figured out, though. There was a war with the Sassanid Persians that wasn't exactly going swimmingly. The two sides agreed to a peace treaty in 532. It was supposed to last forever, and to secure that forever, Justinian agreed to pay 11,000 pounds of gold in the settlement. This would free Justinian up to go after the lost western provinces. The coast wasn't clear yet. A huge urban disturbance broke out in Constantinople in 532, known as the Nika Riots or the Nika Revolt. This was very nearly the end of Justinian and his whole regime. The crowd demanded the removal of some of his administrative appointees, maybe, it's not entirely clear, with the backing of an aristocratic faction in the city. In response, Justinian sent in the troops. They slaughtered thousands of rioters inside the city's hippodrome. It was utterly ruthless, and it secured Justinian's position in the all-important capital city. This opened the way for the next and even more ambitious round of Justinian's project, the reconquest of the West. This was an unbelievably lofty goal. The Eastern Empire was still the most powerful single state in this part of the world, but its resources were a long way from limitless. The Eastern Empire hadn't even beaten the Persians in their recent conflict. Its borders were long. It was surrounded by enemies, from Bulgars and Gepids along the Danube, to Persians along the eastern frontier, to Arabs along the fringes of the Syrian desert. All of these commitments required tens of thousands of troops. Even if the empire had 300,000 soldiers under arms, a reasonable if high estimate for the early 530s, that did not leave a ton left over for an overseas expedition. Justinian got his opportunity to intervene in the West in 533. His friend and ally, the Vandal King Hilderic, had been deposed in 530 and replaced by his cousin, Gelimer. Hilderic fled to Constantinople. He entreated Justinian to help. Once the Persians and the Nika Revolt had been dealt with, the time was ripe. Justinian could present himself as stepping in on the side of legitimate rule. It helped that Hilderic was a member of the Theodosian dynasty, the grandson of the feckless Western Emperor Valentinian III. All of this added up to a clear, easy pretext for war. But serious voices within Justinian's government argued against military intervention in the West. Remember back in episodes 3 and 4 when we talked about the Eastern Roman Empire in the 5th century? They did take a serious crack at recapturing North Africa in 468. It was a disaster. That expedition's failure effectively ended Central Power in the West. It nearly bankrupted the Eastern Empire. It inaugurated 2 decades of instability and strife. Listen to what the historian Procopius wrote about what happened when Justinian wanted to send the expedition. Quote, "When the Emperor Justinian considered the situation was as favorable as possible, both domestically and in his relations with Persia, he turned his attention to affairs in North Africa. But when he revealed to his officials that he was assembling an army against the Vandals and Gelimer, most of them were unhappy about it and regarded it as a mistake. Recalling the expedition of the Emperor Leo and the disaster of Basiliscus, and remembering how many troops had perished and how much money the state had lost." John the Cappadocian, the reforming Praetorian prefect we met briefly a few episodes ago, was the strongest voice against it. The empire's finances were fragile. They could only be squeezed so hard for tax revenues to pay for wars that were sure to be expensive. Those were seriously valid misgivings. The fact that officials remembered those incidents 65 years before so strongly says a great deal about the continuity among the political elite in the East. There was an institutional memory of what worked and what didn't. But Justinian prevailed. In 533, off went the army. His famous general Belisarius was in command. At this point, imperial relations with the Ostrogoths were quite good. They were able to use Sicily as a staging point for the invasion. Quote, "Doubtless fueled by imperial gold," in the words of the historian Guy Housel, a revolt had broken out in the Vandal territory of Sardinia. While the Vandal army and their substantial fleet was away dealing with that uprising, Belisarius landed completely unopposed in North Africa. The campaign was almost embarrassingly easy. Belisarius and his army won a quick battle against the skeleton Vandal force in North Africa and then took Carthage. When the Vandal fleet and army returned from Sardinia, they were again defeated. Gelimer himself surrendered shortly thereafter. At least on paper, North Africa was back in Roman hands. In reality, holding the provinces was way more difficult than taking them had been. The Moors had grown increasingly self-confident and powerful along the fringes of first Roman and then Vandal power. They weren't going to submit without a fight. Mutinies and revolts within the Roman army stationed in the region were likewise a problem. It would be 20 years before the region was fully under Roman control, at great cost and loss of life. This was just the beginning. Italy was next. Winter is coming, and the Texture app is here to help. Let's say you're hosting friends and want to impress. Texture delivers bon appetit and real simple to inspire your event. If you anticipate dinner table debates, arm yourself with the finest reporting from The Atlantic and Time. And when the cold winter hits, let Afar and Airbnb Mag take you away and inspire your next vacation. No matter what mood you're in, Texture and its unlimited access to over 200 premium magazines will help inform, entertain, and inspire you this winter. And right now, you can try Texture for free. Just imagine having your favorite magazines and their back issues anytime, anywhere. To start your Texture free trial, go to texture.com/tides. If you choose to continue, my listeners will get Texture for just $9.99 a month. That's over 30% off their listed price. There are also great gift options available for the holiday season. Go to texture.com/tides to start your free trial today. That's texture.com/tides. texture.com/tides.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Goths had ruled Italy for more than 40 years by the time the Vandal Kingdom fell in 534. In theory, they held it on behalf of the emperors in Constantinople. That had been the deal the first Gothic king, Theodoric, worked out with the emperor Zeno in 489. The Gothic administration of Italy was deeply Roman. For all intents and purposes, it was a straightforward continuation of the old Roman state in Italy. The government was filled with Roman aristocrats and bureaucrats like the great Cassiodorus, who left us a collection of letters that give us a ton of insight into how the kingdom was run. At various points, the kingdom presented itself as the Western Empire reborn. Theodoric even asked for, and was eventually sent, the Western Imperial Regalia. You don't do that if you don't have ambitions to at least present yourself as an imperial figure. From all appearances, that's exactly how Theodoric thought of himself. That's exactly how he wanted people to see him. People seem to have found that imperial presentation convincing. In hindsight, a barbarian king presenting himself as a Roman emperor and his barbarian kingdom as the continuation of the Roman Empire, that all seems pretty dang wild. But we have to remember that at the time, the only real mental framework people had to understand political life was a Roman one. There wasn't really an alternative way of thinking about things like legitimacy, about why somebody deserved to be in charge. That started to change over the course of Theodoric's long reign. Slowly but surely, he started to emphasize the antiquity of his family dynasty. He started to emphasize the idea of the Goths as a special people, set apart by their warlike qualities. Some scholars have called this, quote, increasingly self-confident rhetoric. That sounds about right, but I'm not sure if it's so much self-confidence as the natural growth of an alternative way of thinking about political structures and legitimacy. A short, sharp war between the Ostrogoths and the Eastern Empire between 507 and 509 probably acted as a spur to this. So, after about 510, we can imagine a kind of ideological battlefield starting to emerge between the Ostrogothic court in Ravenna and the imperial court in Constantinople. Imagine you're a bureaucrat working in the imperial government in Constantinople, like those guys we met back in episode 4 on the Eastern Empire. But, like I mentioned, it took some time for this ideological battlefield to take shape. The Eastern Empire was in constant diplomatic contact with the barbarian kingdoms of the West. They had practical business to conduct, they had treaties to agree on, things like that. There was no particular upside to pushing a hardline agenda. Outside of that brief flare-up between 507 and 509, there was general peace across the Mediterranean for decades. Even after Justinian came to the throne, war didn't immediately break out. He waited for his opportunity. Lo and behold, it came. When he died in 526, Theodoric the Great was succeeded by his daughter, Amalasuentha. She was ruling on behalf of her young son, Athalaric. Amalasuentha was nobody's fool. She knew how precarious her position was. At one point, she had even negotiated with Justinian to remove herself and her treasure to Constantinople. As it happened, though, she managed to have her political opponents murdered, and she stayed queen. But Athalaric died when he was just 18 in 534. He had already been wasted by years of hard drinking and excess. This presented Amalasuentha with a dilemma. She could try to rule in her own name, but as we've seen, she wasn't popular among the Gothic nobility. Her solution to this was to marry her cousin Theodahad, a thoroughly Romanized Goth, to help her maintain her grip on power. The marriage did not go well. Theodahad had her imprisoned and then murdered in 535. Once again, Justinian sensed his opportunity. He had been on cordial terms with Amalasuentha. They had exchanged diplomatic letters on numerous occasions. At one point, Justinian had sent a gift of fine marble. This was Justinian's opening, and he took it. Theodoric had been an official partner, if a difficult one. Amalasuentha had been somebody the empire could work with. But now, Theodahad was a murdering upstart with no genuine claim. Remember, at least theoretically, the Ostrogothic rulers still held Italy on behalf of the emperor in Constantinople. Justinian was under no obligation to give the rulers his approval if he had alternative means of enforcing his will. And he did. Justinian launched a two-pronged attack early in 536. One force entered Illyricum on the east side of the Adriatic, which the Goths controlled in addition to Italy. The other, led by Belisarius, headed from Africa to Sicily. The conquest was over almost immediately, Belisarius met no effective resistance. Theodahad panicked. He sent a stream of envoys to Constantinople. He was desperately trying to get Justinian to accept the new state of affairs in Italy. He wanted a peace settlement. Theodahad also offered to abdicate. The Romans didn't bite. Belisarius invaded Italy proper. He overran southern Italy. He sacked Naples, where he'd met some resistance. Rome itself fell to Belisarius on December 10th, 536. For a moment, it looked like Gothic rule in Italy would collapse the same way the Vandals had in Africa. But that didn't end up happening. The Goths were disgusted with Theodahad's double dealing and his attempt to pull himself out of the mess he'd made by negotiating with Justinian. Shortly after Rome fell, Theodahad was deposed, murdered, and replaced with a new king, Vitiges. Vitiges was no shrinking violet. He immediately set off to confront Belisarius with an army. The Goths trapped Belisarius in Rome and besieged him there for more than a year. Over that time, they fought a succession of skirmishes, battles, and full-on assaults, mixed in with the usual misery of famine and disease that accompanied a long siege. Eventually, though, the Goths were forced to retreat. Belisarius went on the offensive throughout 538 and 539. He took central Italy and consolidated his hold on the rest. Both the Goths and the Romans appealed to the powerful Franks of Gaul to intervene on their behalf. Justinian offered gold, and the Goths offered them the territory of Provence. As it happened, the Franks did intervene, but not really for either side. They ravaged and plundered northern Italy and fought both Goths and Romans before an outbreak of disease devastated the army. Finally, Belisarius stuck Vitiges in Ravenna and negotiated a peaceful surrender in 540. Vitiges headed to Constantinople a wealthy prisoner. The war looked like it might be over. Once again, that didn't happen. Things weren't going well for the Romans elsewhere. The Persians had broken the so-called eternal peace and invaded the eastern provinces. A horde of Bulgars had invaded across the Danube and reached the vicinity of Constantinople. Africa still wasn't secure. It was obvious that the resources of Justinian's empire were being stretched to the breaking point. And the worst was still to come. Over the next several years, plagues struck the major cities of the Mediterranean and beyond. This was yet another blow to the overstretched empire and its armies. To make matters even worse, the Goths found an able leader, the enigmatic, mysterious Totila, who came out of nowhere to take the kingship and go back on the attack. Slowly but surely, he wore down the Roman forces in Italy. Town after town and city after city fell, including Rome and Naples. Totila built a fleet and retook Corsica, Sardinia, even Sicily. He ravaged Roman territory along the Balkan coastline of the Adriatic. Ravenna and a couple of other ports were all that remained of Roman territory in Italy. The tide finally turned in the Romans' favor in 551. Justinian's troops destroyed the Gothic fleet and defeated the Goths in their territories along the Dalmatian coastline. A Roman army under the command of the eunuch general Narses entered Italy from the north. In a desperate battle in 552, Totila was killed. His successor, Teias, made the Goths' final stand in an apocalyptic battle on the slopes of Mount Vesuvius later that year. Aside from some mopping up operations, including another brief war with the Franks, the war was over. By 554, Italy was formally reincorporated into the Roman Empire. In the next year, 555, Justinian took advantage, again, of a succession dispute, this time in Visigothic Spain. His armies seized a stretch of the southeastern coastline of Iberia, one of the richest parts of the peninsula, from about Cadiz to Cartagena. How far inland this territory extended is kind of hard to say, but the eastern Romans would hang on to pieces of it until the 620s. On paper, the great Justinian had reestablished control over huge chunks of what had been Roman territory in the west. All of Italy, the most productive parts of North Africa, and the wealthy Mediterranean coastline of southeastern Spain were all back in the imperial fold. This was an enormous accomplishment, but it had come at an incredible cost in blood and treasure. The reconquered provinces of North Africa and Italy would never be the same. The constant, low-level warfare in North Africa had devastated the rich agricultural areas that made the province so essential. But in Italy, it was far worse. 2 decades of constant warfare had killed hundreds of thousands of soldiers and civilians. Towns and cities had been sacked, some of them repeatedly. Peasant villages and rich villas alike had been burned and razed. Rome itself had been captured and recaptured. The former capital was just a shadow of its former self by the time the war came to an end. On the most generous estimate, Italy's population was maybe half of what it had been 20 years before. By the end of his reign in 565, Justinian ruled huge chunks of the former Western Empire. But what he ruled was hardly the same thing that had slipped from the empire's grasp in the 5th century. These territories were depopulated, burned-out husks, not the rich heartlands they had once been. No matter what Justinian's ideological program said, the empire hadn't been renewed. The convenient fiction of a continuing Roman Empire under the guise of barbarian kingdoms was over. What emerged from decades of devastating and destructive warfare was something entirely new. The Roman world was gone. Not all of that was Justinian's fault. At precisely the same time Justinian's armies were reconquering the West, the climate took a sharp turn for the worse. Plague was on the horizon. These natural forces, just as much or more than the Roman army and the imperial propaganda machine, played a huge role in bringing about the end of the ancient world and the beginning of the medieval. That is what we'll discuss next week. Thank you so much for joining me for today's episode. Be sure and drop me a line if you'd like to talk about the fall of the Roman Empire or the rise of the modern world. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, iHeart, TuneIn, and everywhere else you get your podcasts. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound designer is Jeff Schmidt. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. From Wondery, the executive producers are Ben Adair and Hernan Lopez. The associate producer is Leah Sutherland. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.